Good afternoon and welcome to Tuesday Talks at the White House. On Friday, President Obama will depart for a 10-day trip to Asia, where he'll visit India, followed by Indonesia, South Korea, and Japan. Today, we're joined by Jeff Bader, who's the Senior Director for Asian Affairs, and shortly, Ben Rhodes, who's the Deputy National Security Advisor for Strategic Communications, will be joining us shortly. So thank you so much, Jeff, for being here. I'm Corey Shulman in the New Media Department here at the White House, and you've been sending us lots of your questions on the president's trip over the past couple of days. There's also a live conversation happening right now on Facebook. If you go to whitehouse.gov/live, you can click the link to go to Facebook and join the discussion where we'll be taking your questions for Jeff and shortly for Ben to answer about the president's trip during this live chat. So with that, I will turn it over to Jeff, who will give a brief overview of the trip. And then we'll jump right into your questions.
Thanks very much, Corey. When President Obama came into office in January 2009, we had concerns about attitudes towards us in Asia. I think there was a feeling in Asia that the U.S. was distracted and perhaps in decline. The economic meltdown in 2008 and the war in Iraq, in the view of many Asians, had distracted the U.S. From Asia. So we were determined, and the president was determined from day one, to signal that the U.S. was profoundly interested in Asia, that we saw Asia as key to our future economic prosperity and to security. So the president has paid a great deal of attention to Asia since day one. This will be his second trip to Asia. Last year he went to South Korea, Japan, China, and Singapore. This trip will focus on four countries, two of whom are longstanding allies of the United States, namely Japan and South Korea, and two of whom are new partners of the United States, India and Indonesia. All four of these countries are democracies, South Korea, Japan, and India for quite some time, and Indonesia relatively new. In Asia, the president has set as his goal to double U.S. exports in the next 5 years. To achieve that, much of that export growth is going to have to come from Asia. Asia is the source of about 50% of the Asia Pacific region is the source of about 50% of global trade and global wealth. So that's where the future of American exports lies and the future of American jobs and prosperity lies.
Great, thank you. So with that, we're gonna jump right into your questions. As you were speaking, Francine in Tampa asked a question in the Facebook chat, and she wants to know, what is our largest export to Asian countries, percentage of our exports, and will that grow?
I think it varies from year to year and country to country. Certainly, I can't give you the month-to-month numbers, but among the key exports of the U.S. To Asia, certainly aircraft, whole aircraft and aircraft parts are always in the near the top or at the top of U.S. exports. In addition, U.S. agricultural products are a huge percentage of U.S. exports to Asia, particularly to countries like Korea and Japan, whose agriculture is not nearly as developed as ours. I think sort of generally high technology products, electrical products, computer and IT-based products.
Great. Thank you. Now we're going to take a question that came in from Justin Dart. Justin had submitted these in advance on the White House Facebook page. He asked a number of questions. We're going to cover as many as we can. So Justin asked, how are you going to help boost American-made exports to Japan, Korea, and China? The trade imbalance is out of control.
Well, one of the things that will be happening on this trip is the meeting of the Group of 20, the so-called G20 countries. That meeting will be in Seoul. It's an annual meeting. Actually, it's been semi-annual for a few years. That groups the 20 largest or 20 of the largest, most important economies in the world to try to integrate and coordinate global economic policies. One of the key issues on the agenda for that meeting will be how to sustain balanced economic recovery. And so one of the issues that's been of concern to the U.S. and many of our partners has been exchange rates. I'm certain that the issue of exchange rates, in particular the Chinese exchange rate, will be something that we'll talk about at all the stops. At the Group of 20 meeting, I think we'll be talking to all of our partners about ways to reduce global individual countries' deficits and surpluses as a percentage of GDP. That's a proposal that we've made. We think that undervalued currencies serve as a trade advantage for those countries whose currencies are undervalued. We have argued that the Chinese currency needs to be allowed to move towards a market-based level. If the Chinese currency moves in that direction, we think that other currencies that are undervalued, including those in Asia, will move as well. I think that's very important to addressing the trade deficit problem. Then, of course, there are lots of things that we're doing at home to address those issues.
Okay. Justin goes on to ask, where will you visit in Japan?
Japan, that's for the annual meeting of APEC. The APEC meeting will be at in the city of Yokohama. So that will be the only stop on the schedule in Japan. We're not going to Tokyo on this trip.
Justin also asked, is the president going to be discussing North-South Korea relations?
Yes. That issue, I am sure, will arise in President Obama's meetings in South Korea with South Korean President Im Yong-bak. In addition, in meetings with Japanese Prime Minister Kan. Both of those countries are involved, have been involved in the six-party talks on the North Korean nuclear program. In addition, President Obama, when he's in Seoul, will meet Chinese President Hu Jintao. I think it's predictable that the issue of North Korea, North-South relations, and the North Korean nuclear program will feature in those talks. You know, our view is that in the wake of the sinking of the South Korean naval ship, the Chonan, by a North Korean torpedo, that it's critical for North Korea to address South Korean concerns about that attack and to give assurances to the South about its future intent, that it will not be aggressive and will not attack the South. If the North can give satisfactory assurances to the South, then we can contemplate moving back towards six-party talks, which would be hosted by the Chinese, that would involve the Russians, the South Koreans, Japan, North Korea, the U.S. And what we would need for those talks to resume would be some sort of an indication, some clear indication from the North Koreans that they are sincere in seeking to get rid of their nuclear weapons program. They committed to that in a declaration to the six parties in 2005, but in past negotiations, past dealings with the six parties, they've been one step forward, one step backward, sometimes two steps backward. We don't want to resume a process that has that quality. We want sincere movement towards denuclearization.
Okay, the next question comes from John Stephen Dwyer. John asks, will the president's trip to Indonesia afford any opportunities to see friends or relatives?
It's a pretty short trip. It's unfortunately less than 24 hours. This is a long trip for the president. We'll be gone for 10 days, four countries, and we're not able to go to Indonesia for as long as we'd like because of the fact that we have to get to Korea and Japan for the G20 and the APEC meetings, and of course we have the election today at this end, and those are constraining the schedule. So the visit to Indonesia unfortunately will not give the president the opportunities that he'd like to have to see friends and relatives. It'll be focused more on his meeting with President Yudhoyono of Indonesia and a speech that he'll be giving to the Indonesian people on the second day at the University of Indonesia. President is very popular in Indonesia, as you know, and we expect a good crowd for that event.
Okay, this is another question that comes from John Stephen Dwyer. North Korea and its arsenal sometimes seem like the international elephant in the room that no one wants to mention. Do you anticipate the president discussing North Korea during any of his stops?
Yes. As I indicated in response to the question before, certainly at a minimum in Korea, South Korea and Japan, and also the meeting with President Hu of China. Since President Obama came into office, we've been looking for a way to get North Korea to take its commitments more seriously than they have until now. As you know, they had a nuclear test a few years ago. They had another nuclear test last year, despite the fact that they've made commitments to dismantle their nuclear program. So we are working very closely with the South Koreans, consulting intensively with them about North Korea and about policy towards North Korea. This is not an issue which we're going to solve on our own. We need a concerted approach by our allies, South Korea and Japan, and the other regional powers, China and Russia, to persuade North Korea that it's in its interest to dismantle its nuclear weapons program if it wants ever to enjoy the benefits of a membership in the international community. Right now, North Korea is the most sanctioned country in the world. And that's going to remain the case until and unless it takes convincing steps towards dismantling its nuclear weapons program. So this is the number one security issue in Northeast Asia. We are very closely aligned with the South Koreans and Japanese on this issue. And we'll be talking to the Chinese. And I should also mention that President Obama will be seeing President Medvedev as well on the visit. The issue could well arise in that meeting.
If you're just joining us, go to whitehouse.gov/live. There is a link to join the Facebook discussion. We're taking your questions from the Facebook chat live right now for Jeff. This one just came in from Nick Nonsi. Aside from the G20 meeting, what does the president expect to achieve from the visit to Indonesia, India, et cetera? What's the administration's Asian strategic policy?
Well, in terms of strategic policy towards Asia, as I said at the outset, the president sees Asia as a major, if not the major, source of future economic growth in the world. The Group of 20, which was formed a few years ago, of its 20 members, six of them are Asians. Much of the growth in the world in the last two decades has come from Asia, and in the decades ahead, that will absolutely be the case. So in terms of U.S. economic interest, there's no region in the world that's as important as Asia. I would single out five or six countries as sort of critical to our economic objectives in Asia and to future growth, four of whom the president will be visiting on this trip. India and Indonesia are huge growing economies, and Korea and Japan are two of the most powerful economies in the world. If you add to that China and the growing economy of Vietnam, you have a very, very substantial portion of global economic growth. In addition, U.S. security interests are profoundly engaged in East Asia. We're forward deployed with our military in the region, notably in Japan, where we have a presence of upwards of 40,000 troops, and in Korea, where it's about 28,000. The U.S. military presence in the region, our forward deployment, has been the foundation of stability in the Asia-Pacific region for the last five decades. The countries in the region all want us there. If there were any indications of the U.S. losing interest in Asia, then the chances of intra-Asian tensions, if not worse, would rise substantially. So we're trying to send a message, the president is trying to send a message on this trip, that not only are we in Asia to stay, but that we are increasing our involvement and our interests in Asia. Let me just mention one other thing, Corey. There is a group called the East Asia Summit, which consists of 16 countries in Asia. There's basically sort of 16 core members, countries in Asia, the so-called ASEAN countries, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, India, Australia, New Zealand, South Korea, China, and Japan, that has a meeting every year for the last 10 years. President Obama has decided this year that we should join this organization, seeing this as the most important future political security organization in the region. And until now, we have stayed apart from it, but President Obama has decided that we need to signal that we're going to be involved in the key political and security decisions and decision-making body in East Asia in the 21st century. So Secretary Clinton went to their first meeting as an observer last week, and President Obama will be going next year.
Thank you. This question comes from Craig Long, and he asks, does this mean more outsourcing of U.S. jobs in exchange for more profit?
That is not President Obama's agenda. That's not what we're doing on this trip. We are not going to be looking for opportunities to increase outsourcing. We'll be looking for opportunities to increase American exports and the jobs that are associated with American exports on this trip. That will be a principal topic in all four stops, as well as policies, barriers to market access for our products, and issues such as currency, which prejudice the ability of our products to compete on a fair basis. In the meeting with President Hu of China, I think it's highly likely we would be discussing not only issues like currency, but other trade barriers, intellectual property rights issues, industrial policies in China, innovation policies in China that we feel discriminate against U.S. market access.
Okay, thank you. If you're just joining us, go to whitehouse.gov/live. There is a link to join the Facebook chat where Jeff is answering your questions live right now. I'm scanning the chat. This one just came in from Christina Yang. As the U.S. re-engages with Asia, is increasing military presence, as Secretary Clinton said in her speech, the best way for U.S. to renew leadership in the region?
We're not talking about increasing military presence in the region. What we're talking about is sustaining the U.S. military presence at a level that provides assurance to our allies in the region and provides stability in the region and thereby decreases the chance of conflict. We're not looking to increase the U.S. Military presence in the region. We've been looking to modernize our alliances in the region, principally with Japan and South Korea, where we have troops, where we maintain a troop presence, also with Australia, Thailand, and Philippines, where we do not have a troop presence in Thailand and the Philippines. But the goal is not to increase troop levels, it's to sustain them.
Okay, thanks. The next question comes from John Stephen Dwyer. He asks, this seems like a very friendly trip that will focus on strengthening connections between Asia and the U.S. Does that preclude the president from mentioning hot issues surrounding China, like pollution, civil rights violations, and nuclear proliferation?
Good question. China is obviously very much on the minds of every country in Asia. China's emergence, China's rise is the focus of attention not only in the United States, but among all countries in the region. All of these countries have long histories with China. None of them wants to have a hostile or adversarial relationship with China. At the same time, none wants to be dominated by China. So the countries in the region all welcome the U.S. presence. as, if you will, kind of a balance as China emerges. Now, I expect that probably in each of the countries on the visit, that our interlocutors will want to hear about U.S. policy towards China. And I expect that's a conversation that President Obama would have at each stop. The issues that you mentioned are among the issues that feature in the U.S.-China relationship on, excuse me, on civil liberties, which you mentioned. The president has been vocal and public about our concerns about freedom of expression and imprisonment of people for nonviolent acts of political advocacy. So I expect that issue would arise. Nuclear proliferation issues. On that, we see China as an important partner for our efforts to prevent Iran from developing nuclear weapons and our efforts to roll back North Korea's nuclear weapons program. So China, we don't have reason to believe that China is engaged in proliferation of nuclear weapons or nuclear technology. They have nuclear weapons technology. They have made commitments not to do so. So we see them on those issues as a potential partner. And the other issue you mentioned, environmental degradation, climate change is very much an issue in our relationship with China, with India, with Indonesia, with all of the countries we'll be visiting on this trip. China has passed the U.S. as the chief emitter of greenhouse gases, although, as the Chinese point out, on a per capita basis, their emission levels are much, much lower than the U.S. But you know, we are looking to get strong commitments from China and other countries about how we attack this problem. The commitments may be different depending upon a variety of factors, including level of development, but that doesn't mean that we don't take these issues as an important part of our agenda with each of these countries.
Okay. The next question comes from Christina Yang. She asks, as the U.S. reengages with Asia, I'm sorry, I just skipped to the wrong question. We've already...
we had Christina.
Yeah, we had Christina. This is from Diana Walker. We don't need to re-answer Christina's question. Diana Walker asks, during the trip, will there be any focus on global health issues, such as the elimination of polio, measles, et cetera?
I would expect in Indonesia, health issues will be part of the agenda, will be something that the president and President Yudhoyono talk about. We're going to be announcing a comprehensive partnership between the U.S. and Indonesia on this trip, which will cover the whole range of economic, political security, and social and people-to-people issues, including health. So I think that's the stop where I think the issue would be most likely to arise, and India as well.
Okay. The next question comes from Kumu Gupta. She asks, what are some of the long-term strategic goals for U.S.-India relations?
Well, we are looking to elevate the U.S.-India relationship to a whole new level. This is a relationship that, during the Cold War, suffered from considerable misunderstanding and distance on both sides because of history. We're past that now. India is taking its rightful place in the international community, both politically, economically, and in security terms. We're looking to build the U.S.-India relationship to new levels, to have a strategic partnership with India in all of these areas. India is one of the fastest growing economies in the world. It's a nation of over a billion people. It is under Prime Minister Singh. It's been pursuing economic policies that are allowing the Indian people to begin to achieve their full potential as a global actor. We'll be looking to take advantage of all of these factors to build this relationship to a new level.
Great. The next question comes from Linda Hayward. She asks, I'm wondering about a collective energy project to keep America moving forward. What could the collaboration with foreign governments look like? For example, trade agreements on electric cars, for one. Is it possible to merge companies so some jobs can stay in America and some with whatever country would share the costs so both benefit? Thank you for what you have accomplished. Good foreign relations is better than bad. And we have Ben Rhodes joining us. So.
Sorry, I'm late, everybody.
On electric vehicles and cooperation on clean energy, several of the meetings on this trip will have energy as an important part of what we're going to be talking about. We have a clean energy agreement with China. We've established clean energy research centers in China and the United States with investments by the governments on both sides, designed to find ways to cooperate on issues surrounding the development of electric vehicles, around efficient buildings, around alternative sources of energy. So the president will be seeing President Hu Jintao on the trip. That is part of our agenda. Similarly, in Japan, we also have a framework for clean energy cooperation that is run by our Department of Energy. And part of their agenda is also cooperation on electric vehicles.
Thanks. So during that response to the question, Ben Rhodes, who's the Deputy National Security Advisor for Strategic Communications, just joined us. Thank you. We have some great questions that have come in. This is from Chanpreet Singh, who says, I have just one simple question for you. Why did Mr. Obama cancel his trip to the Sikh temple during his visit to India?
Mm-hmm. Sure, I can take that one. There's been, I know, lots of talk about this, particularly in the Sikh community, but I think it'd be wrong to say this was canceled. I think what happens when we visit a place like India, which is, of course, a huge and extraordinary country, we look at many different places to potentially visit. We send out advanced teams to look at scores of sites, including far more places than the president would ever have time to visit. Frankly, he'd love to go to India for far more than 3 days and have the opportunity to visit multiple cities. However, when we got down to making his schedule, given that we're there for 3 days, we settled on the two cities that we're going to, Mumbai and New Delhi. And that was to serve the principal purposes of the visit, which include a business summit in Mumbai on the first day when we're going to talk about deepening our economic cooperation with India, to include some Diwali celebration and a town hall with some university students in Mumbai. And then there's a very extended official portion of the visit in New Delhi that includes all of the president's meetings with senior Indian officials and the prime minister, a state dinner, and a separate dinner with the prime minister the first night we're in New Delhi. So we had a very full schedule in 3 days that frankly, unfortunately, prevented us from being able to go to all the places that you might want to visit during a trip to India, which of course would include something like the Golden Temple, which is such an extraordinarily important site, not just to Sikhs, but one that is widely respected for the extraordinary charitable work it does as well. So it's unfortunate that we're not able to get to more places, and we're sorry that it did not work out on this visit. But of course, hopefully, we'll have an opportunity to go back to India in the future during the Obama presidency and visit a broader spectrum of sites. But we're very excited about the three-day program we have. Even though it feels short in some respects, it's actually the longest amount of time the president will have spent in any foreign country as president, the 3 days he's there. And that underscores, I think, the importance of India to us and to our foreign policy.
Thanks. Kuma Gupta asks, what dates will the president be in India specifically? And can you speak a bit on what he hopes to accomplish there for Diwali?
Sure. Well, we're leaving on Friday, November 5th, arriving on Saturday, given the distance that we're traveling. And then we're in India on Saturday and Sunday and Monday, and then leave on Tuesday morning for Indonesia. So we're there for 3 days and three nights. Saturday we'll be in Mumbai. Sunday we'll begin the day in Mumbai and move on to New Delhi. And then, of course, on Monday is the official program in New Delhi. In terms of Diwali, last year we were very excited to host a Diwali event celebration here at the White House, underscoring again the importance of Diwali as a wonderful holiday. We know it's one of the largest and most anticipated holidays in India, and it overlaps with the President's visit. So he specifically wanted to have an opportunity to celebrate Diwali and to do so with the Indian people, and again, getting beyond simply his official business. So what we're doing is on Sunday morning, the President will visit a local school in Mumbai. And at that school, he will participate in a Diwali celebration, which includes lighting a lantern, which is something that is, of course, common to Diwali celebrations. And then the President will have an opportunity to watch some school children perform a cultural dance associated with Diwali as well. So he'll have the opportunity to celebrate Diwali with these school children in Mumbai specifically, and with the Indian people more broadly.
Thank you. This question comes from Yotika Sood. Yotika says, I'm an Indian journalist writing an article on U.S. President Obama's visit to India scheduled for November 6th. They have a number of questions, but I'll just address a couple of them. How is the U.S. government planning to collaborate with India on agriculture? Which areas of interest that would you be interested in discussing during the dialogue between the U.S. president and his Indian counterparts?
Yeah. Well, it's a great question, and agriculture is one of the areas that we're highlighting during the trip. First of all, there's a great tradition of cooperation between the United States and India on agriculture. The Green Revolution, which helped lift millions and millions of people in India out of poverty, is a hallmark of that collaboration, and the United States was so honored to play a role in supporting India's rapid efforts to lift people out of poverty. Prime Minister Singh and the President talked about this in their very first meeting in London. Prime Minister Singh obviously is one of the the leaders in India who's most responsible for the efforts to lift people out of poverty, and they discuss how technology and innovation is helping people in rural India, understanding how many people in India, majority of the population, still live in rural settings, how innovation can support the kind of agriculture that allows people to have a broader food base. And that's the kind of cooperation we're going to announce in the course of the trip. And in fact, our USAID Administrator, Raj Shah, and our Agriculture Secretary, Tom Vilsack, are going on the trip. And in Mumbai, they're going to have a roundtable with some of their counterparts and some Indian farmers to discuss ways in which technology and innovation can help, again, increase food security for Indians. And that includes things like technologies that allow you to predict the weather, so you can, again, gear your crops towards more efficient use of your efforts and again, predict the kinds of weather that will allow you to enhance your food security, the kinds of technologies that will help farmers get their products to market. So there's a whole host of innovations and technologies that we want to focus on in the area of agricultural cooperation. And the President is going to be able to drop by a particular event where, in addition to this roundtable, there will be kind of an expo where some Indian farmers will be able to highlight these technologies. Now, one additional exciting component of this is the bilateral cooperation between the United States and India, again, can support continued efforts in India to lift people out of poverty, but they can also help people around the world. And as you may know, the United States has been part of a food security initiative in Africa where we're trying to, again, apply technology, innovation, capacity building to help African farmers lift their countries and their peoples into a higher standard of living. And we see great potential for the United States and India to cooperate, not just within India, but in African countries as well, to apply the extraordinary lessons learned within India and the extraordinary innovations made by Indians to support development in other parts of the world. So it's an exciting collaboration, both in terms of extending the progress that's been made within India, but also extending that progress into parts of Africa that, of course, are in bad need of development.
Thanks. The next question comes from Melton Bell. Intellectual property discrimination was mentioned as a concern with regard to Obama's trip to China. How much will this concern be addressed in India and Japan?
Jeff, you want to talk about the China?
Okay. Well, what I said was that President Obama, in his meeting with President Hu Jintao, the meeting will be in Seoul, likely would discuss intellectual property rights issues with China. something close to 80% of all pirated goods seized by U.S. Customs come from China. So IPR issues are of particular concern with regard to China. Japan and Korea have pretty advanced intellectual property rights protection regimes. So we don't have a particular broad range problems with those countries on IPR issues. We coordinate with them in trying to raise global standards on IPR and trying to figure out how to deal with problems with problem countries elsewhere, but not with those two. Ben, yeah. I don't know if you want to say something about India.
Yeah, I think with India, it's certainly we've not had the same level of activity around the set of issues as we have with the Chinese. However, of course, it's part of our ongoing dialogue on a range of economic issues. Again, as India's economy emerges and becomes a more and more important market for our goods and a partner for us in the international economy. And our view is always, again, to just work with countries to make sure that they're abiding by the rules of the road and that the playing field is level for American companies. But I would not say that it's at the anywhere near the top of the agenda of issues that we'll be discussing in India.
Okay, this question comes from Kiki Zhao. President Obama is spending less than 24 hours in Indonesia, but almost 4 days in India. Is U.S.-Indonesia relationship not as important as U.S.-India relations?
Well, I'd just say a couple of things. First of all, the president obviously has very deep personal ties to Indonesia. So just on a personal level, it's a country that he lived in as a boy, that his sister spent a good portion of her childhood in, that his mother spent a good portion of her life in. So he has a kind of deep tie to Indonesia on his own personal basis. Similarly, it's an extraordinarily important country to the United States. We're developing a partnership with Indonesia in a whole host of areas, from energy to science and technology to education to security cooperation, that we see as really fundamental to the future of U.S. engagement in Southeast Asia and U.S. engagement in the world. As an emerging democracy, an emerging market, and the world's largest Muslim majority country with also a great history of pluralism and tolerance, we see Indonesia as a very natural and important partner of the United States. In terms of the time, obviously we had a problem earlier in the year where we weren't able to get to Indonesia on a specific trip because of a variety of reasons, including the end of the healthcare debate and the oil spill. However, we felt it was very important to get there this year because the president was eager to include Indonesia on the itinerary of his next trip to Asia. This particular trip, we'd always long planned to go to India, and we have a summit in Korea for the G20 and then in Japan for APEC. So we had a limited time window, frankly, of days to deal with, and we had already built, the India trip out. However, what the president has said to President Yudhoyono of Indonesia is not only are we coming on this visit, we'll have the opportunity to have bilateral talks and to have the president give a speech to a large crowd of Indonesians and have a program in which he visits the Istiqlal Mosque and is able to underscore his own personal connection to Indonesia and his appreciation for the Indonesian people. But next year, we anticipate we'll get to go to Indonesia as a part of our summit business. So we also did this trip knowing that not only will we have a stop in Indonesia this year, but we'll also get to go to Indonesia next year as well, which is not the case, frankly, with India, for instance. So while we have a shorter stay in Indonesia in 2010, we also know that we'll be getting back there in 2011, so that gave us some confidence that we'll have an opportunity to do even more events and more engagement with the Indonesian people in the future.
I mean, just to add, I think Ben's covered it very thoroughly. The president has met with President Yudhoyono several times already. This is not going to be the first time they've met. I think the mere fact that the president decided to go to Indonesia on this trip, which was already quite crowded with other stops, because he felt it was really essential, as Ben said, to get to do such a trip this year, reflects the importance that the president personally attaches to this relationship. This is the largest and most important country in ASEAN. This is the third most populous democracy in the world, and as Ben mentioned, it's the largest Muslim majority country in the world. And I just add that I suspect that President Obama is the first president in history to speak Bahasa, the language of Indonesian. So this is a stop with particular importance to the United States and to President Obama personally.
Okay, this is our last question. And a couple of folks have asked it in different words. John Stephen Dwyer asked about the logistical challenges of the president spending a few days on the other side of the globe. Richard Pendle asked, pointed to an article in the India Economic Times, asked if it was true that there are 40 airplanes that go to India, 600 hotel rooms in the Taj Mahal, sort of the footprint of the trip. Can you speak a bit to that?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's an interesting question. There's an extraordinary amount of work that goes into planning and executing any presidential trip. As I mentioned in response to an earlier question, you have kind of the advanced teams that go out and look at the different sites that the president will be visiting. You have the embassy or consulate on the ground that is coordinating those stops. And you, of course, have our staff here at the White House and the State Department working to plan the president's trip. In terms of the footprint that you described, the variety of things go into that. Part of it is simply the traveling staff of the president and the delegation traveling with the president. And so, for instance, in India, we have a large delegation. We have several cabinet secretaries going, Secretary Geithner, Secretary Locke, Secretary Vilsack, Administrator Shaw from USAID, and a number of other officials. So we have a large delegation there. We have a large delegation, obviously, related to the G20 summit. And so that adds, of course, people to the footprint. But at the end of the day, the biggest presence that the United States has is related to the security of the president. Now, that's not a decision made by us here at the White House. That's entirely left up to the Secret Service. We basically take their cue in terms of what it takes for them to secure a presidential visit in different stops. And that includes everything from the security around the hotel to the president's motorcades. So again, that's a question that is handled by the Secret Service. And then in terms of moving the president around, he'll obviously travel on Air Force One the entire trip. There's usually a support plane associated with this kind of travel for additional staff and others. So there's a lot that goes into it, a lot of planning, a lot of different components of the U.S. government. And then at the end of the day, again, the large footprint that you describe or cite several articles often speaks to the security requirements that come with the Secret Service. But at the end of the day, we still try to structure the trips in a way in which the president can interact with not just heads of state and heads of government, but ordinary people along the course of his visits. And I think we've managed to do that with each of these stops. In India, he'll speak to hotel staff at the Taj at the beginning of his trip about the terrible attacks of 26/11 in Mumbai. He'll speak with entrepreneurs and business people at his business summit. The next day, he'll visit a school, see some children who will be able to report to him on the kinds of work that they're doing in their school. He'll have a town hall with university students. And then on throughout the trip, in Indonesia, we wanted to make sure he could speak to a large crowd of Indonesians, given the enthusiasm we know that exists within Indonesia for this particular president, having, again, spent some time growing up in Indonesia. So we try to, even as we have to carry a official delegation and have appropriate security, we try to have the president have the opportunity to engage local communities and ordinary people along the route of his foreign travel. And frankly, that's often the parts of the trips that the president enjoys the most. He enjoys interacting with people from different countries around the world. He enjoys interacting with young people in particular, and you'll have noticed if you followed our foreign travel over the course of the last 2 years, we often do town halls, roundtables, student events, so that he's speaking to young people in these countries as well. So that's the balance that we try to strike, and a good and successful trip is one that usually allows us to do a lot of official business, but also to reach out beyond the halls of government to again, engage with peoples in different countries.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Ben and Jeff, for joining us. Thanks so much to everyone that participated in the live chat on whitehouse.gov. If you joined us late, this video will be posted on whitehouse.gov shortly. And also stay tuned. We'll be keeping you up to date with lots of updates throughout the trip next week. So thanks so much.
Thanks, Sarah.